Okay, well, thanks for dropping in. We might actually need all the social distancing that is possible in here. There are only, I think, two people in this class currently isolating because of exposures. So not every empty seat is an ill person, but please do keep in mind that rates are rising in New York City again substantially. We will go from supposed green to supposed yellow sometime in the next 24 or 48 hours. It's nice that this is happening right at the end of the term. Your educations, such as we may claim to be providing to you, will not be harmed by this, no matter what happens. But I'm not sure that mass gatherings like commencements will be such a good idea in the third and fourth week of April, as previously had been supposed. Don't worry, of course, it's all very mild. You know, only people like me should still be quite afraid of catching whatever version of the virus will be current here this summer. I want to spend today mostly on tech, because that was the collective decision that we made last week, right? So instead of a second essay to write, as you all recall, by collective decision of those few voters in the room, you're going to be doing technical exercises 1 through 4. And of those technical exercises, only one, the first one, which I'm going to talk about intensively in a moment, is monitored in the sense that you can prove that you have done it to me. The other exercises are all related to the control of identity, and if you could prove to me that you had done them, then that would have defeated the whole purpose. So you are on the honor system in your privacy with respect to the last three. That means that almost all the work of the course that can be graded, which is, of course, the only work that really counts, will be the two versions of your first essay, the first draft of which you have already my views and are forming yours and making lines outside my office. I wish, too, that time could be dealt with in a relative kind of Einsteinian way, but we're not moving close enough to the speed of light. So all those office hours I had earlier in the semester are no longer reproducible, and we're all going to be crowded. Please do come by. I'm happy to talk to you, but we all have less time than we had at the beginning of the term. And as a man going on leave, I feel that quite intensely, since I know I won't be teaching until next January. I feel like I am doing the work of trying to provide all the educational services possible in a limited time. Therefore, because we have only two classes left, and I want to spend most of this on tech, and I would love to spend the last class mostly trying to sum over everything I think that I was trying to say. We lose a little bit of the discussion I had intended for this afternoon to try and bring conclusions to the idea, what if government actually were trying to make technology beneficial to people's rights? There may be some questions left over from last time, and if there are, we should start with them. Otherwise, I'm going to try and sum over that topic quickly in order to come to what is now de facto our topic, which is not what if government were trying to increase respect for rights, but rather what if you were trying to increase society's respect for your rights simply by manipulating the technology around you, which is what the technical exercises fundamentally amount to. But I don't yet want to abandon entirely the social perspective, what if government were trying. And I certainly don't want to leave unremarked upon a piece I put on the radar after it was published last weekend. That is Ronan Farrow's excellent inside reporting on NSO and Pegasus and the compromise of the world's smartphones. Ronan Farrow may be the single most productive graduate of the Yale Law School presently alive, certainly more productive than me, in addition to sparking an enormous social movement along with competitors at the New York Times by catching Harvey Weinstein in the full vigor of his evil. Ronan has now started another matter of importance to the world by reporting as extensively on NSO and the arms trade in spyware for smartphones as he has. There is a connection, which is implicit in the piece. When Ronan was rushing after Harvey Weinstein, he found himself up against an Israeli intelligence service and covert actions company called Black Cube, which was an interesting subject. I assume he postponed until after he had finished the primary project. But it's apparent from the writing about NSO that Ronan got to the sources that took him inside NSO and that caused NSO's CEO to give him privileged inside access to the company because he was chasing Black Cube, which had been buying technology from NSO. Who is the CEO of NSO, repeatedly points out to Ronan Farrow, as the interviews that made this piece I have offered you to read were constructed, Shenov keeps saying, remember, everything we do has the approval of the Israeli government. And all the rules that the Israeli government made to deal with spyware were written by the Americans. So one of the things that it is sort of crucial for you to take away from Farrow's reporting is to remember that this seemingly unregulated, you know, trade in cyber weaponry that is the NSO spyware that has done all of the fine work that it has done, demonstrating all your vulnerability all the time, is an engineered entity devised by the Americans and by their deeply sympathetically joined Israeli kin in the international intelligence services and arms trade. We are indeed looking at a thing that was designed for government purposes by governments with deep agreement of governments, operating through smart entrepreneurs in a free world economy, which is now, like, you know, Stinger missiles, doing good work in the places where destruction is supposed to happen and busily winding up in the hands of people where destruction is terrorism and criminality and horror and evil. And all of this is the ironic consequence of everybody doing exactly what they wanted to do to save the world and doing it together with the deepest of good intentions and cooperation. Now maybe you will understand why I believe that what motivated me as a young person to start working on these problems was science fiction about nuclear weapons. Because my generation experienced this at the beginning when some other technology similarly created with the best of intentions by really smart people operating in a world of governments on the side of good and right and all of that created the ability to destroy humankind within minutes and caused the young people who were the naive observers of this system, along with the creative artists of imaginative fiction who supplied them with their entertainment growing up, all of us together recognized the thing that could occur and learned it with a vigor that the adults who did not want to experience the sharpness of living under 22 minutes warning of nuclear destruction every single day of their lives were not really given to teaching us either. They had other purposes, including livings to make. What Ronan is showing in his reporting on NSO is how far down the pathway that began at Trinity we now are. It's why, although you don't think this is true, I think of those smartphones in your pockets as spy satellites and nuclear devices aimed at you. It's why the ease with which the technologies that you have learned to call convenient can be repurposed against you. And why it is absolutely inevitable that well-intentioned governments and wonderful, smart entrepreneurs and... But you must also understand, therefore, why in the course of Farrow's reporting, as he documents the Facebook people trying to keep WhatsApp from being penetrated and turned into a weapon of mass destruction by NSO, I find myself aware of the fact that there has never been a moment when I trusted the good guys. Which is probably how, in the early 90s, we came to be trying to make and keep from going to jail for making technology, the purpose of which was to make it possible for you to distrust government in future, and to keep the bright people who could, of course, read all the world's email from reading yours, and why it was that we were then treated by our government as, well, as Stuart Baker used to say, pedophiles and nuclear terrorists. Back then, too, pedophilia was a thing that got launched around in American life to destroy people. I had a bet of a nickel with a reporter on the crypto beat, which didn't mean cryptocurrencies, it meant cryptography, back in the early 1990s. The bet was anytime Stuart Baker, formerly of the NSA, and I appeared together in public, would he accuse me first of nuclear terrorism or of pedophilia? And the nickel was on which one would go first. The treatment that we then received was easy because we were just, you know, anarchists. And the treatment that Sheriff Julio and his colleagues at NSO are getting is over harsh in ways that are familiar to me, even though they are indeed international arms merchants. But for a reason that should be deeply appreciated by everybody in law school, if they're international arms merchants with the total permission of their own government after total and complete consultation with the government of the United States that runs the world, then they are respectable arms dealers and should be treated as such. And yet, it is only an accident if the arms are not aimed at the thing in your pocket, and only at the thing of somebody else. A thing being carried by somebody who is a more senior reporter or a better human rights lawyer than you are at the moment, but you're going to grow up to be these targets. So that's what's on the radar, and in the middle is what would happen if governments were not doing that, but were as firmly committed to the defense of their people's rights as they are committed to the production of clever arms, which will ultimately kill not only the right people, but also the wrong people. What if the government took seriously the concept around which I want to, or thought I wanted to end this element of the course, which is the concept of cyber peace? What if governments were affirmatively committed to the idea that the net should be returned to a condition that defaults to peace, and that rejects efforts at theft and violence and war as best it can, which is engineered for civil purposes, and which is also engineered to make dual use difficult, to prevent that which is civil from becoming that which is uncivil, wherever possible. What would it then be like? It would, of course, be constitutionally like being committed to a more perfect union and domestic tranquility. It would represent, in that sense, an 18th century constitutional idea. It used to be, in the time of John Marshall the First, the time that we regard as the great time of constitutional creativity in the United States, notwithstanding certain defects, it used to be in the time of John Marshall that reading the preamble to the Constitution was an important thing to do. if you look back at the cases that make that the great time of creativity in constitutional law, Marbury against Madison, Collins against Virginia, and McCulloch against Maryland, you discover that one of the things that the great Chief Justice does is to read the preamble to the Constitution for the purpose of discovering its principles. Back when I was an 18th century American legal historian, that all made good sense to me. That is, after all, how judges read statutes in the 18th century. And in the great now dust-collecting digital versions of my American legal history lectures I will never give again, the one about John Marshall treats that a reading of the preamble for the purposes of the principles of the Union as a distinctive characteristic of Marshallian constitutional interpretation. But there's nothing disrespectable about it just because John Marshall did it. To create a domestic union, to create a more perfect union and to ensure domestic tranquility are purposes that a constitution in the 21st century ought to serve. Which doesn't mean that because obviously Facebook does not create either a more perfect union or any domestic tranquility that it should be prohibited. That is, after all, what the First Amendment is about, is freedom of the press. And if Mr. Zuckerberg wishes to abuse the network in the way that he has done, he is constitutionally entitled to pursue it, as we are constitutionally entitled to have nothing whatever to do with it. But what government ought to be doing is neither the having nothing to do with it nor the letting it all roll, however it rolls, point of view. That was never what government was for. Not if it's for creating a more perfect union and domestic tranquility, but if that's what it's for, it shouldn't be into cyber war either. So what I would have been saying if we weren't about mostly to talk about you, if I had been still going on in the disembodied law school constitutionalism kind of way, what I would have been saying here is, what if we understood not the failure of the Fourth Amendment or the success of the First, not the 14th Amendment's incorporation of these doctrines and therefore their modification, their metamorphosis into rules about the rule of law everywhere within the society's borders all the time. What if we were to get beyond clausification and even beyond the sentences which are the amendments to the question of the purpose of constitutionalism in the 21st century society of the network? Where would we discover that cyber peace, that the re-engineering of society to provide for forms of connectivity that liberate without destroying, and the result in the peoples knowing more without the peoples being more known, could actually be treated as the overarching principles around which a lot of other material, including a lot of other constitutional material, would have to be organized in the 21st century. Here I would have been saying something about the part I had to skip in part one, when we might have been asking, under what conditions are people free to assemble peaceably, and how can something no more extensive then NSO spyware afflict their ability to assemble peaceably? At which point, I suppose we would have asked, what role has NSO spyware played in the assassination of journalists in Mexico? And what does that teach us about how people may digitally assemble peaceably in the 21st century if they are subject to sufficient degrees of individual surveillance that people who hate them know where they are to kill them when the time arises? Which, as long as you have a smartphone in your pocket, I know that the people who hate you can find. No. Can purchase on the market, can subject to the munitions available to people who know how. The United States government lost control of a number of its weapons over the course of the last 3 years. Most of them in a leak from CIA, of the CIA's own internal tools, because remember, organizations as big as the United States, unlike organizations as small as Israel, don't have to manufacture arms only that can be sold externally. They can manufacture arms on which they don't need to turn a profit by selling abroad. The CIA's hacking tools were mostly disclosed by an organization which has never been satisfactorily identified, and about which indeed U.S. intelligence doesn't seem to have any particularly good theories, called Shadow Brokers, which released a series of CIA hacking tools called Vault 3. I only have two copies of these tools in my apartment because I don't care very much about them and I don't need to be a conservation user of them, but if I have two copies of those tools in my apartment, where on earth do you think the copies of those tools aren't? Not all of them are as good at breaking into mobile phones as NSO's Pegasus is. Most of those tools are really small arms in the world of cyber activities. Nothing that happened to be in the CIA's possession had the kind of reach that Pegasus does. But then CIA is not a major producer of tools. The extent to which in the world around you effort has been focused on technologies that, if pointed at you, will destroy you. That is, if pointed at you by people who have any intention to hurt you, should be sobering enough that we would want to say, yeah, actually, in the end, we don't want to have to depend on government. Our aspirations that European regulatory bodies will take care of this for us are insufficient. Our belief that ultimately antitrust work is going to break up the corpse called Meta and that will be helpful. Good. But truthfully, I, not just as a citizen, because I don't think you're going to grow up to be just citizens, you know. My aspiration for each and every one of you is that you will grow up to be somebody worth killing to somebody else in power. Wouldn't that be the wish? It's true that the people who listened to me never pointed an AK-47 at me and pulled the trigger. He was quite a different fellow. But it has been part of my assumption all the way along, because my little bunch of people had a tough time in the 20th century where half of all the Jews who lived were murdered. It never really occurred to me growing up that safety was a thing that you could count upon other people to provide you without limit. Collectively and individually, I think that was somehow part of what we took away from the 20th century. And there's no reason not to be as conscious of that in the 21st as it was back then. Even threatening nuclear war is back in fashion as of today. So almost all of the conditions which caused us to worry about these questions, the nature of the history through which people have passed in recent decades, the present examples of the perfected despotism of both, you know, merely efficient and unpleasant kinds. In The Guardian this week, there is a column I did not put on the radar because it isn't directly speaking to our needs, by a British writer living in the suburbs of Shanghai, referring to herself pseudonymously as Mary Jones. And she's just writing about what COVID control measures in a zero COVID society have meant for people like her living in family life in the neighborhood of an A-class city over the past 2 years. But part of what she is talking about as part of the basic factual recitation is, for example, how if your smartphone wasn't running the correct version of the contact tracing mandatory application, you couldn't enter a supermarket. I recognize that this doesn't bother you as much as it would bother me, since there is no smartphone running no mandatory application of any kind in my life, and apparently starvation is the cost of software freedom. You, of course, can imagine updating them. But consider the way in which, again, with the best of intentions and for the purpose of saving lives, what is being demonstrated is the extent of mandatory social control that arises out of the spy satellite in your pocket, out of the determination to use technology a certain way. And only because that particular technology pattern, which we might call cloud, pipe, mobile, as Hoyt did, only that particular technology pattern adventitiously results in the levels of social control and spying and location for purposes of coercion, whether beneficial or harmful, that particular pattern allows. It's why there isn't a smartphone in my life. Because where we came from, I and the kids like me who helped to build all this stuff in the first place so long ago that it doesn't even matter anymore what things we were building, email, networking, operating system design. The lesson that we took from that was the immediate danger that misapplied technology could produce. We were handed a world full of nuclear weapons into which we were born. The first generation of human beings who had been born into a world in which grown-ups could push a button and destroy everybody. We helped to build infrastructure for the world we live in now, in which for the first time in human history, everybody can be connected to everybody else all the time in possibility or in substance. And every brain on earth can learn whatever it wants to learn, wherever it is, without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government on the one hand, and totalitarianism can be perfected technically on the other. And power can be in every place, watching and hearing and affecting all the time, in every transaction, in every relationship, in every dwelling, in every school, in every place of worship, all the time. So, what then would we do if we were doing for ourselves? And this is where we have collectively decided to end up. Which feels, in a way, kind of weird in a law school course, theory first and facts later, but maybe not such a bad thing. The facts are, as Albert V. Gore Jr., not President of the United States, said in the PowerPoint slide deck with which he invented to change the world, the facts are an inconvenient truth. By which I mean about this only that the facts are going to come into conflict with what you refer to as convenience. The technology pattern that we are using is convenient. Everybody understands that, though I think we use the word in different ways. And it is, of course, inconvenient to consider fundamental alterations of habit. So the exercises are designed not to confront that. We are leaving the smart-ass phone undisturbed. It's in your pocket. It is always there. It is watching you. It can be used to blow you up. You know that you are living in a free fire zone with respect to listening. You understand that tools that actually turn your life inside out are readily available, that bad people as well as good people have them, and that they are used in bad as well as good ways, and that the more important you are in society, the more important the work you do, the more effective you are at doing all the things that it is your ambition to do, the more likely they are to be turned on you. But still, we accept them as a given. All the exercises I am now proposing about what you would do if you wanted to make more respect for your rights mandatory to everybody else, all those things are based on the assumption that the weakest link in the chain will remain in your pocket indefinitely and that nothing will disturb it. I wish that weren't true. But it is. So let's try and imagine then what it would mean to construct technologies that are protective of your rights forward from a position that existed before the beginning of the smart-ass phone and was in effect historically precedent to it. Even, you might say, a failed effort to prevent it, which is pretty much, I guess, now in retrospect how it looks. I didn't think of it primarily as preventing this particular kind of harm. The particular pattern that developed, the form factor of the bad thing in your pocket that you think enables life, was not immediately the goal of the thinking. The immediate goal of the thinking in the beginning was preserving secrecy, to make it possible for human beings to live in a network of computers that would ultimately embrace all of their communications, though this was initially thought of in a world of text communications, writings, to make it possible for human beings by themselves to assure the survival of their ability to keep and communicate secrets. By the time I started to worry about that problem in a professional way, in the late 1980s, that problem was already apparent in the growth of electronic communications in the net. Email is now, for almost everybody who uses it, a postcard delivery system, in which everybody who encounters the message in the process of its transmission is capable of reading it. Almost all of you, and indeed almost all literate people in many parts of the world, have decided not only that, but to entrust the process of delivering your email to a spy system. Hence the reason that I paid the money to keep renewed the domain name kgbmail.net, also kgbmail.info, because kgbmail is the mail that you all have mostly decided to use. Not only a postcard delivery system, but one in which an intelligence service does the delivery of postcards and keeps track of every postcard's origination and points of delivery. Having worked on email since it was young, as I say, I spent the summer of 1975 writing what the two of the three of the authors still around think of as the world's first network distribution system for email, I am astounded at what happened. It wasn't exactly this, that KGB would take over the mail system of the world, that I was anticipating in the late 1980s, but we knew it was a possibility. It just, our fiction was more realistic. So the question is, how do we keep secrets in this age? And how can you turn that technology of secret keeping so it is more under your control and does more work for you? In the early 1970s, a quartet of cryptographers around the world, mathematicians, came up with an application of some interesting number theory, which provided a completely different technology for secret keeping than had ever previously existed. Humans, until the end of the 20th century, until the early 1970s, humans made secrets in communication by sharing a secret among all those people who were subsequently going to have secret communications with one another. Code books work like that. Right? They group in a dictionary style, every group in the code language against clear text, and so by dictionaries you can make changes. Ciphers, which are not codes, but algorithms for concealing information, ciphers from Julius Caesar on are all things in which, if you know the rule of the cipher, you can break it. If you don't know the rule of the cipher, the key plus the mechanism, then you can't read the message until you break either the algorithm or steal the key. But all of these systems depend upon a shared secret that precedes the effort to communicate secretly. You and I meet somewhere secure and we make a rule or we publish a code book or we do something, and then elsewhere in the world we can communicate secretly. What Whit Diffie and Ron Rivest and Ari Shamir and Edelman were doing in the 1970s was to figure out how people could communicate securely without any previous sharing of secrets between them. This mathematics produces what is called public key encryption. And it depends upon a digital device, a way of running a program, which has a simple of architectural real-world analog. I was looking at one as I was walking along the west wall of Barnard College on my way to work today, the night deposit box. Banks in the 20th century, when people used cash money, had night deposit boxes. That's an object built into the wall of the bank. On the street side, there's a lock with a key, but that key is issued to every depositor who has night deposit privileges. It's a public key. And when you put something into the box, opening the public door, it falls down a chute into a spot which can only be accessed from inside the bank. On another wall, where there will be a much tougher lock with much tougher requirements for getting into it, including multiple keys that two people have to open or time locks or whatever. The night deposit box is then the physical world equivalent of what public key encryption is supposed to do. There was a movie in the late 1960s about the tender and complicated topic of wife swap. Art Garfunkel of Simon Garfunkel was in it, so it gained a certain greater cultural value than the subject would have justified, and it was called Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. I forget which one was Garfunkel. I should remember. And the cryptographers liked it, so all the rest of all our lives, we've been using Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice as the characters in our little stories about secret communication. And I'm going to do justice to the system here. So let us suppose then that these four people are going to communicate secretly in various permutations and that they want to keep secrets from one another and so on and so forth. And each of them then will have a public key. That means it's published, right? And you could have a directory. Bob has key 1317, et cetera, and Carol has key 2936, et cetera. These are long numbers. Ted has this, 3437, and many other digits, and Alice, 5854, et cetera. And each of those is public. Everybody can know them. If you want to send a message to any of these people, you look up their public key, and you run the public key through some encryption function, which takes the public key and the original message as its arguments and produces the crypted text, right? You can't read it once it's been encrypted, and nobody else can read it except the person who has a secret key, which she, he, or they keep to themselves, and which allows that message to be read. So that if Carol sends a message to Bob, Bob now runs the decryption function on his private key, and the crypto message, and he gets out the original message back again. That process of asymmetric procedures in which the public key can be used by anybody to make a message secret to the recipient, to the owner of the public key, and which can only be read by the possessor of the private key, is the source of all secret keeping that we nowadays use for all sorts of communications on the web. And I'll show you a little more about that in a moment. Questions so far? All of this stuff builds on the layer underneath, so the time to ask the question is right now before I build anything on it and make it more obscure. Yeah?
I didn't catch what you mentioned about a public key being used by anybody to make a message secret to the owner of the public key.
That's right. See, here's the example, okay? Ted or Alice or Carol can all send a secret message to Bob. They look up his public key. They take the original message that they wish to send him. They put it through some encryption function, and they get some cryptext out. All right? But the only person who can read that message is Bob, because he's the only one who has his private key. He uses the private key and the crypted text he receives, puts it through the magic decryptor function, and he gets the original message back. That way, like the bank safe deposit box, anybody can open the outside door, but only the owner of the key pair can open the inside door, because that person is the only person who possesses the private key.
Is what Signal uses?
Yeah, we're going to get to all the services, but everybody is built on this one way or another, okay? Everybody is based upon the proposition that you can have secrecy without previous exchange of secret. That all you need is a public key. We'll begin modeling all the various ways in which this works. The Signal WhatsApp, the web itself. Now, all of these are applications in one form or another of this basic set of relationships. So is GPG. So is the original of all of this, which was our attempt to make public key encryption for the masses, which is what we started fighting with the U.S. government about in 1991. Okay, so far we have this layer, okay? There's a machine called an encryptor, and there's a machine called a decryptor. One of them uses a private key. Everybody uses the public key. That way we have secrecy without prior exchange of secrets. The only things we publish are public keys. The possession of the private keys allows us to read. Now, let's just make one slight turn in this process. Here we have a way for Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice to communicate secret messages. But now look at what happens if we use the machinery in a slightly different form. Bob takes a message he wishes to send, and his private key, and his public key and he puts that through the encryptor. I'm sorry. If I get confused, then I will be confused. Bob takes the message and his private key, and he puts them through the encryptor. Alice, receiving this message, says, okay, I'm going to use the decryptor. I'm going to put Bob's public key, which I know, and this message I received from Bob, through the decryptor. And by God, I'm going to get back the actual message that was sent. And that could only have happened if Bob's private key had been used for this encryption, because only his private key would have produced the original back again if the public key were applied to it. Now what I know is not the content of the message, which is not the secret. Anybody can read it. They just have to use Bob's public key to decrypt it. What I know is that the message for sure came from Bob, or rather came from whoever it is who controls his private key. If his private key is under good control, then the only person who could have sent the message that his public key would have opened was him. That's a digital signature. That's the system that we use for making digital signatures. The way we authenticate digital documents to prove that they came from X or Y, even if we are using DocuSign to dress all this up for us in a shitty kind of way and keep track of who is doing it, which is the purpose of DocuSign, to spy on signing. But no matter how we are doing it, no matter which way the service of signing is proposed, ultimately it comes down to this math. This is how it's done. A party signing has a secret key, which nobody else has. That is used in the same structure to encrypt the message, which is actually, for these purposes, not a secret. It's a document being signed. And because the encryption pairs work correctly, we can be sure that the party who originated it was the party who possessed the secret key. And every time in the net you find yourself doing some form of digital authentication or another, it is one version or another of this mathematical relationship. Question? Unencrypted signed email.
Okay.
If you wanted to make a secret and then prove that it came from you, then you would indeed go through those processes. Secretization first and signing second. Why? Because the way this part of the process actually works is to keep track of the content that was signed. Right? If the content has changed in transmission, this decryption won't work. So signatures also authenticate not merely where something came from, but that it hasn't changed while it moved, which is, of course, the necessity of the document that authenticates, right? It has to both say where it came from and has to be able to prove that it hasn't been modified. That's why we use funny paper for checks.
Could there be a way for a third party to pretend to be involved? If the public
Sure, they could put up a public key in the directory that says I'm Bob.
How can you check if that's true?
By one form or another of signing the keys so that somebody takes authority for them. And we'll come back to how that works when I begin to show you what differentiates HTTP and HTTPS from Signal from GNU-PG. Because one of the fundamental differences in these various digital tools is that they use the same math in different contexts in order to deal with what you have just identified, which let us call the trust problem. Because ultimately, there are two things that are involved in any effort to make the net safe in this way, one of which is secrecy and the other one which is trust, and they're directly related to it. But in complex ways that we should tease out a little bit. Yes? Ah, this is a good question. We cannot assure that all private keys are unique, because if we were assuring it, we'd have to make a collection of them, right? So the real question is, how can we make private keys such that we have very, very, very high confidence that they don't collide with one another, even though we can't check? And that has to do with why, as I say, there are a lot of digits here. If I say to you, pick a 4,000-digit number, and I say to some other people in the room, pick a 4,000-digit number, what is the likelihood that those numbers will collide? Well, if they're actually picking 4,000-digit random numbers, they will not collide. It will take a large part of the remaining history of the universe before one of them is generated twice. What we really depend upon isn't assurance of the avoidance of collision. We depend upon the profound unlikelihood of collision. There are some other things we can do in the math to make collision even more unlikely. We can use algorithms which, when presented with very similar inputs, produce wildly dissimilar outputs. Generally speaking, that's what we mean when we talk about hash functions. Hash functions are functions which are wildly insensitive to their inputs, so that a hash function which takes an integer will produce a number completely different if presented with 2 and 3. We do everything we can in that, in those little subsidiary mathematical machines, to say that if you invent a number randomly, even if it's close to somebody else's number, the hash of those numbers will be wildly different. And that's why we like to use these little number blenders in order to deal with this. But we don't resolve the problem by a certainty. We resolve the problem by vast improbability of not. Okay? Other questions? All right, so far we've demonstrated how we keep secrets and how we sign documents. We've therefore demonstrated a third thing which you need to keep in mind, which is that if the algorithm or structure for keeping secrets has a backdoor, then so does all authentication and certainty of origin and content of documents. To put it in the bluntest way, if somebody backdoors the system that keeps your secrets, they can also forge your passport. The two things are closely related enough, not quite as immediate as I am saying, because we can use different algorithms for digital signatures than for public key encryption. But at the end of the day, every time you hear somebody advocating for backdoors in secrecy, you should understand that they are also advocating for backdoors destructive of certainty, of authentication, of persons and documents. Every backdoor is both things at once. Law enforcement officials around the world love to talk about how it would be good to have backdoors in crypto so you could catch criminals better. They don't like to have it pointed out, though it is inevitably the case, that that also means that there will be people who can perfectly masquerade as you. All right, so now we have three points. First, how we keep secrets. Second, how we authenticate. Third, how the relationship between how we keep secrets and how we authenticate ties us to having either much less of both than we want or more of secrecy than some people in society will want. After all, there will always be people who don't want wrongdoers to be able to keep secrets. The web, the hypertext transport protocol, is, as you are all aware, not secure. The way the web was built, when Tim Berners-Lee was trying to think about how to get physicists' papers more rapidly published at the European Research Network, CERN, the hypertext protocol network that Tim invented based on the work of Ted Nelson that everybody had forgotten, was not intended for security of transport. That means two things. It wasn't intended to conceal what was being transported. The web didn't contain secrecy. And it didn't authenticate that the server any particular hypertext request was sent to was indeed the server of John Smith Co. It didn't authenticate sources in the web. Both of those were weaknesses in the original design, and both of which were treated as we treated many network protocols in the middle 1990s, as a thing that we could fix by modifying the protocol to add a layer of security and authentication on top of an existing set of rules. That is, we made the hypertext transport secure protocol. as we did with the email protocols, PAP and POP and IMAP, as we did with a bunch of other protocols that built the net, when people began to realize that extended into the fullness of the real world, the protocols were insufficient in security forms, we simply tried to put something over the top. So what happens when you use the net in a secure way? You have an endpoint with a browser in it, and you want to have a talk with HTTPS, www.mybank.com, which is, of course, the most important form. If we can't secure financial transactions in this net, then this is not the net that people will use for financial transactions. So what is it that actually occurs? The first thing that happens is the browser reaches out and it says, could I have a certificate? Right? That's a public key. Give me a public key, Mr. Website, please. And that actually means, would you sign a challenge for me? Mr. Bank, I'll send you a string, you sign it and send it back to me, and I verify that it's the same string I sent you, and therefore I know that you have the secret key that corresponds to this public key, and I'll look up the public key in the list kept by somebody, and that will tell me that you are indeed mybank.com and not a 12-year-old in St. Petersburg impersonating. Right? So that authentication step having happened, then they say, could we have a crypto handshake, please? And what that means is the browser will say, I have a certificate. Never mind that there's no worldwide directory of me. I have a certificate. And you have an ability to check that I have control over that certificate. And when both of us know that we have control over the certs, then we can use public key encryption to send an encryption key we're going to use for this conversation. And then the other guy can say, yeah, I have that key. I can verify that the key you have nominated for this conversation is a key that you sent me and that nobody has changed in the middle of the transaction. And now we'll use that key to make secret discussions between you and me. Because the first step was done at the server level, nobody after that will know what pages in particular you took from that server. Because the requests will be encrypted. And nobody will be able to see the content of what you took from the server because the content of the messages that were exchanged between the web server and you will be encrypted. You will therefore have a more or less secure ability to talk to a party that you know to be mybank.com. Question? A good question, like your original question about the trust problem, would be, okay, that sounds like a pretty good system, but where was this magic list of all the websites in the world that have identities that are checked out? Who decided that there was mybank.com? And what could go wrong with that system? So the first answer is that there are a lot of people in the world called registrars, right? And they sell mybank.com domains and things like that. And they also are identity registrars. That is to say, you go to them and you say, this is going to be the key of my corporate web server from now on. Please check me out, prove that I am who I say I am. And then put my key in the list of keys you know to be held by the people who have got good keys with you. Right? So they are a first-level bunch of trust keepers. They're the ones like VeriSign or Thought, whose business is to certify people's keys. They make trust. VeriSign took money from MyBank.inc to certify the keys of MyBank.com. They became the trust vendor from whom MyBank bought the ability to be sure inside your browser that the people you're talking to are MyBank.com and not the 12-year-old in St. Peter's. But of course, as Plato would have noticed, now you need some people to watch the registers. Who's got the list of what are acceptable registrars? And if a registrar is crooked, if a registrar is taking money from drug dealers to pose as MyBank.com and certify their keys, then what? So in this world, the world of the so-called secure web, the answer is that ultimately the maker of the browser has a list of trusted registrars. Let's call that Google. Microsoft, Firefox, down here in type actually 1 nanometer high Opera. Which one of these things is not like the others? This you should know. What's the difference between Google, Microsoft, Firefox, and Opera? Which one is not like the others? The Firefox Foundation is not like the others. It's not a profit-making business, and it doesn't control an ad tech platform. You mean the browser that you use and which determines who you trust is made by a profit-making corporation that runs an ad tech platform? Gee, I don't know. I think that's not a good idea. Why is that? It's not true that only one of them is free software. Google makes Chromium, which sits inside the Chrome browser and is its basic rendering engine and way of talking to the net. And that's free software. Google releases it under open source license because it's like all the other software in the world. It should be made our way. And Microsoft's Edge browser uses Chromium. And Brendan Eich's Brave browser, a pro-privacy browser, truly, uses Chromium. In other words, all the browsers except Firefox are made by profit-making organizations. Well, Brave is now an exception, too. All but these are made by profit-making businesses that run ad tech platforms, and they all mostly use all the same code? I don't think that's a good idea either. Now you know why I advise that you get Firefox. Let's just begin by saying, why don't we use the code made by the people whose concerns are us, instead of the people who buy us? That's easy. You can even do that on your smart-ass phone. It doesn't do any good because it's on the smart-ass phone. But one thing we would want to do is at least deal with this. Now, what we have established here is that the form in which we use public key encryption in the secure web deals with your trust problem hierarchy. There's a bunch of registrars who are supposed to be good, and there's a list of good registrars kept by the browsers. And the browser manufacturer should at least have a meeting to discuss this, because now they are actually responsible for managing trust on the web, and no particular one of them wants to be uniquely responsible for managing trust on the web, because they're all going to get it wrong. There are overtly corrupt registrars. The United Arab Emirates, as a matter of fact, just an inconvenient historical truth, ran a really crooked registrar for a very long time until the outside world discovered it and there was shame in Abu Dhabi. Sometimes registrars think they're good, but they're not. A Dutch registrar made an incredible mistake leaking everything because its own internal operations were insecure back 5 years ago, and just laid waste to a whole bunch of assumptions about who was really authentically who in Europe. Every time a registrar is either crooked or makes a terrible mistake, of course, there are a whole bunch of cyber warriors in the world who have long since taken advantage of that. The Americans and the Chinese. And then, of course, sometimes there's state-sponsored thuggery inside the browser. Lenovo has an unfortunate record over the last decade of frequently shipping laptops with Microsoft Windows on them with lists of registrars which are not quite honest and which allow certain Chinese entities to spoof being mybank.com and anybody else they feel like. And the browser won't notice because it will say, yes, this is authentically Citibank, but it isn't really because there's a corrupt root of trust in the list inside the browser. So, to begin with, then, we can say about the secure web that it's made of the same tech, but because it has hierarchical arrangements for trust, it's subject to vulnerability. We can, of course, do all the same things with instant messaging. Public keys will be derived from phone numbers. Yes?
I just have a question. I'm not sure I understand the difference between Chromium and Chrome.
Chrome is Google's way of dressing up the engine which is underneath. Chromium is a common part.
Okay.
Chromium is a bunch of code which makes a browser. It makes a browser in the sense that it implements rendering, that is, it turns HTML and JavaScript and CSS into pages you can read. And it does transport, it does the doing the web, and it does a whole lot of intermediate stuff, too. You can take Chromium and put dressing gowns around it, themes, skins, whatever you want to call them. Google produces Chromium in a skin form, which is called Chrome. The browser Chrome using the tools Chromium. Microsoft produces a browser called Edge, which is Chrome with, which is Chromium with other dressing gowns wrapped around it. And so is Brave.
How about Safari?
Oh, Safari, I forgot. There's an Apple Computer Corporation. It makes its own, and it ties it to its own ad platform, and its own root of trust, and everything else. It's a very, but do people really use it? Anyway, I guess there's some jewelry that runs Safari. No, that's correct. As it doesn't make any money from Android, why should it need money? It's getting the world's data.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, those are two different things, and the search engine too, of course, it is a place which is really important to control, and which Google uses to understand the wishes and hopes and dreams and fears of the human race. And a browser like Firefox will have a default search engine. And the Firefox Foundation made a ton of money, just hundreds of millions of dollars over a decade and a half, because it was worth it to Google to pay Firefox a lot of money to exist as long as the search box defaulted to Google. And one of the important issues among my comrades over these years has been whether the Firefox Foundation did or did not make good use of that money. Because everybody, including Firefox, knew that it would end one day. And now that Firefox has 3% of the market and Chrome has more than 2/3, you can guess that paying Firefox to keep the Google search box, not a very big deal anymore. And not how the foundation will live to make Firefox. But then that takes us, of course, to the other question, which is the one that you are asking. So what is Google getting from Chrome? The negotiation with Apple over what the search box should default to in Safari is an important subject. Apple doesn't run a search engine. Okay, so now all of that I... Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry, we shouldn't spend too much time on this. Browsers are big complex machines made of many parts. Chromium is like a prefab browser. It's got most of the important parts that a browser can have. Google uses those parts to make its browser Chrome. Microsoft uses those parts to make its browser Edge. Because after all, once you have a prefab house, then you can paint it different colors and put different window dressing on it and make different products and sell them in the house market. But at the end, free software wins because nobody wants to invent the wheel again and again. And Google provides the wheel in a form that allows everybody to make use of it without intellectual property problems, which you know a little bit about having originated. And therefore, everybody can use the parts, and therefore everybody makes the product, and Google benefits because its parts are in everybody's thing, and that creates a dependency in a world of complex relationships. More about browsers?
So Google made Chromium the open source.
Google made Chromium open source from the beginning. It was never anything else. The Chrome was never anything else. As the operating system, Chrome OS was almost entirely free software too. As Android is, as you know. Yeah, that's right. Google co-opted our revolution and made what it made. And the time now comes when maybe our revolution should do something back. Which is kind of why we're standing. See? More about browsers, or can we go to the point about the IM? See, again, you're going to see the same story. WhatsApp is Signal redressed. Right? And that's because it's even more trustworthy to use Moxie Marlin Spike's algorithms than to use ones that Facebook made up for itself. All right, so here we are in the world of instant messaging doing the same job, right? Like the secure web. We're going to have a public key, which is going to be tied to a telephone number, and there's going to be a private key, which we're going to securely store for the user or allow the user to store on the user's devices, as the user may prefer. And we're going to do key negotiation by public key each time. And then we're going to put people in a channel which is encrypted by their private key, which is encrypted to their public keys, and which therefore can only be read on the phone using their private keys, on the phone or however they get those keys there. The consequence of which is to provide, again, like the secure web, for a system with a root of trust. And the root of trust is WhatsApp or Signal or whoever is running the service. This is a centralized process. My comrade, Moxie Marlin Spike, who created all of this, thinks that centralized processes are good. He disagrees with me about the argument in favor of federated services that I was offering here last week. Moxie's view is that centralized services are good because you can fix them when they break, and the fixes will immediately be applied to everybody, and everybody in the world will have them, and that's obviously very convenient. It is. And it is obviously a good idea for Facebook to take the open source free software Signal algorithms and to build them into WhatsApp because we can trust them better because Moxie built them than we could trust them if Zuckerberg built them. And once again, this is about the trust problem more than it's about the algorithm of encryption because the question is, who are you supposed to trust? WhatsApp says, well, you can trust us because we don't have user secret keys, so we don't have access to the content of their messages. Which is all very well unless you understand that WhatsApp is not selling the content of the messages they're selling. Who talks to whom and about what? When? Where? All of which is very valuable information if, for example, you're a political party trying to run an election campaign in which you're pressing the hot buttons of people and influencing them by messages sent directly to them that nobody else can read because they're end-to-end encrypted. So by doing it this way, you open a trust problem which is essentially as wide as national politics. And you begin to have insight into why, for example, The BJP Karnataka IT cell head was telling Mishy and me two general elections ago that they had 80,000 WhatsApp channels in the Karnataka state election. That's 80,000 unmonitorable, end-to-end encrypted channels bringing into a conversation like-minded people who have been identified by all the psychographics that Facebook has about WhatsApp users. That is, who are they? What do they like? What's their taste in music? Well, what do you think happens when they know who you're talking to and how often you talk to them, whether it's a member of your family or a priest or a political friend or et cetera, et cetera? They don't know exactly what's been said, but they have a very good idea who is saying what to whom when, which often identifies what's going on rather specifically. And of course, the people who buy psychographic information connected with your WhatsApp account aren't buying it because they know what you said to your sister. They don't care what you said to your sister, but they are buying it because you talked to your sister. People don't influence people they don't talk to. Want to control influence in society? Keep track of who talks to whom. This is what is known as the social graph. What WhatsApp has to sell is the social graph of several billion people. How often do they talk to one another? How tight are their connections? What is their relationship in the real world? What are the patterns of those communications, and when are they changing? And who puts whom in which groups, connected to which products, or product sellers, or intermediaries? Who adds whom to what? All of this information may not be quite the same as knowing exactly whether you talk to your sister about the football game or her crush. But people can pretty much believe that the crushes and the football games will come up. Does that help? Okay. Anything else about this? All right. So here again, we have the trust problem solved hierarchically. Everybody on WhatsApp trusts Zuckerberg. Everybody on Signal trusts Moxie. And so on. But of course, we don't have to do it that way. Now, let's just think about some other services that lie nearer on the, yeah.
Signal is more secure than WhatsApp.
Because you trust Moxie more than you trust Zuckerberg?
I don't know whether it's technically something that...
Technically, you should assume that they are close to the same. Because the underlying algorithm of encryption, the basic structure in which the security is undertaken, is the same. What will be secure about Signal is that it will not have incorporated lots of bells and whistles that are in WhatsApp. It will have avoided making features that are potentially security destructive, because its only concern is security. WhatsApp's concern is not security. WhatsApp's security is product and engagement. Let's take the example that was offered in Ronan's coverage of NSO. One of the high moments of tension depicted in that article between NSO and Facebook is occurring as Facebook is learning in real time that NSO has broken into WhatsApp and is now capable of compromising the phones of any WhatsApp user in the world. What has happened? Facebook has, of course, added wonderful features to its IM that aren't present in, say, something as parsimonious about attack surface as Signal. Facebook has given to WhatsApp users the power to send a little packet in WhatsApp that will change the ringtone on the receiving handset. Very convenient. You can imagine, for example, that the commercial users trying to use WhatsApp to communicate with people buying their products will love this feature. They will be able to use a ringtone to notify the oncoming message from L'Oreal that is one of their jingles, or what the fuck ever. Okay? Their Signal will not have done this because it isn't playing for engagement, and it won't therefore have opened this terrible security. Because whatever the Facebook team did, or the WhatsApp team, pardon me, I should respect cultural and corporate boundaries, whatever the WhatsApp team will have done that implemented that you can use a message packet to change ringtone, had a hole in it which allowed other code to be run. And they were using it to start bootstrapping their spy product by taking advantage of the fact that they could, without any intervention at all from the user, just send a change of ringtone message which had a trap in it. So WhatsApp will be less secure than Signal because WhatsApp will make every mistake that a profit-making, feature-filled organization will make. And some of those will result in serious security problems that will be taken advantage of by an arms manufacturer. Around the corner at Signal, a nonprofit corporation which provides services and technical assistance and which helps people to set up secure networking, secure messaging networks, and is also responsible for the creation of the Signal protocol, there will be no inclination to put stuff in there that could blow up in people's faces. They will make mistakes, but they won't make mistakes that are produced by trying to produce cute technology to enthrall 16-year-olds. Does that help? The technology pattern, after all, of Signal is make freedom, put freedom in everything, turn freedom on. The technology pattern in use at WhatsApp is make money. See, there was a time about 15 or 20 years ago when I woke up in the early morning having done some thinking in the middle of the night, and I was overwhelmed with self-congratulatory sense of my own wisdom. I could not believe how smart I was. I had figured out in my sleep why capitalism inevitably provides bad technology. I thought to myself, oh my God, it's so simple. Capitalism is motivated by profit. And every time technical superiority is in conflict with profit motive will win out, and over time there will develop a space, like an economist's shaded rectangle, between the technology we could have had and the technology we got instead because the profit motive got in the way. And I just could not believe how smart I was. And a couple of months later, I was, for completely different reasons, reading the letters of Rosa Luxemburg. And I discover in a letter from 1926, about a year and a half before they murdered her and threw her in the river in Berlin because socialism is bad, Rosa Luxemburg writes to somebody, it's in her journals, and she says, capitalism produces inherently inferior technology. Because capitalism depends upon the profit motive. And every time that profit conflicts with the achievement of technical superiority, capitalism chooses profit. And over time, we build up a difference between what we could have and what we have. And therefore, when we have socialism, you will see technological miracles that nobody could ever have anticipated. And I thought, good. I'm not so smart after all. The problem was they murdered her. Which is what happens to people in my movement, which is why we begin worrying about encryption. Freedom of thought has taken it on the chin for 1,000 years. Because there was somebody listening. All right, so now we have a set of structures which are built around public key encryption in these various forms, and they depend upon hierarchical structures of trust. And when they are in the hands of platforms, the tendency is for the hierarchical structure of trust to put the platform at the root. Let's take a further example, okay, of video conferencing. Actually, of course, Zoom had no security at all when it became the tool of choice for the world. It was about as laughable a set of bullshit maneuvers to avoid having to think about security as you could get. And the essential security that it had was HTTPS. You joined the Zoom and you use HTTPS and the server authenticates with you and then it conceals in theory from the world which conference you are joining, and then all that video and audio streams moving back and forth is encrypted to the endpoint by HTTPS. Of course, the one place where there is no secrecy or security is on the server, because HTTPS only works in a one-way, in a one-segment direction. It doesn't go to do anything further as you move through the net. And everybody has to trust Zoom, because the hierarchical solution to the trust problem is there's only one really trusted party, which is Zoom, and then there's a lot of other. Which isn't a very good security structure, even if Zoom isn't a Chinese company whose servers are in China, after which it's not an acceptable solution at all. Now, we could create some form of secure protocol for video conferencing. This is generally the government solution. The United States government and other governments around the world with capacity to make lots of software have their own encrypted video conferencing structures, which are either good or bad, depending upon what happens when you attack them. But they don't produce secure communications for society. They produce secure communications for a government that trusts itself. These are like military applications of public key encryption, in which the trust problem is also solved by hierarchy. Generals tell people to distribute keys. Keys are distributed by people who work for generals. Colonels get their keys from generals. Lieutenants get their keys from captains. And the way the trust problem is solved is by following the hierarchy of society. Now let us suppose that we decompose these things into their parts, like browsers into engines and dressing gowns. Let's suppose we decomposed all of this into its parts, and we said, now, let us get you immediately close to the system of public key encryption. What we want to do is to make it possible for everybody actually to know how this works, and to control it in some environment which deals with all the technologies in a reasonably simple metaphorical way, and which affords you the opportunity to deal with the trust problem differently. This is the set of technical problems that were being solved by my not quite yet client Philip Zimmerman when he created PGP in 1990 and 91. Pretty good privacy, so-called, was the attempt of an amateur cryptographer living in Boulder, Colorado, to make a tool that would make secret keeping possible for ordinary people using the most sophisticated public key technologies then in existence for the purpose of preventing the United States government from controlling cryptography. In an early example of government attempt to prevent free software cryptography, Orrin Hatch had proposed as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in the Ronald Reagan's midterms, after he gained control of the Senate in 1986, Orrin Hatch, as the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, proposed a great big bunch of criminal law improvements, S1, which contained a use encryption in a crime, go to jail for more time. We are criminalizing the use of encryption for criminal purposes in the United States provision. And it was that effort in the United States Senate to control encryption by criminalizing some uses of it that caused Phil, sitting in Boulder, to say, you know what, I'm just going to make a thing that makes it impossible for them to do that, because I'm going to create industrial strength, strong encryption for human beings. I'm going to spread it through American society, and government will. It was a free software revolutionary gesture. And his code was really good. And although he was an amateur cryptographer, he didn't then make any very serious mistakes. And what he had was proof of concept plus running code for the idea that we could make public key encryption a phenomenon of civil society. He had to invent a couple of things in order to do this, none of which are the tough crypto parts. First of all, he needed a simple metaphor for explaining to human beings how this works. So he said, well, you've got two key rings. You've got a ring full of public keys. Those are all the people you know that you can correspond with in a secure way. And you have a key, a much smaller key ring, which is your private keys on a ring, each of which is the key to some identity of yours that keeps secrets or authenticates its presence on the net. You could have multiple secret keys. Some might belong to small groups of people who want to have all shared secrets and signings, like a law firm, for example. And some of them might be your real identity, and some might be some pseudonyms of yours. But you have a public key ring that shows everybody, and you have a private key ring, which is every identity you control or have control over. And then you have a program, which might be some menu-driven thing, or it might be some command line program, but its job is to do basic things. Encrypt this, decrypt that, sign this, verify the signature of that, manage my key rings. Let me add or delete or review or sign keys. So the first invention that has to lie on top of public key encryption is the metaphor of the key rings and your ability to manage them easily using a program that's not hard to grasp. The second great invention, and this is the greater of the great inventions, is to solve the trust problem in a completely new way. Phil's rule isn't that key rings are authenticated by somebody, that there is a person who authenticates a key. Phil's principle is that the keys are authenticated in a web of trust in society. So now let's look at how Technical Exercise 1 works. Technical Exercise 1 says you on your computer, your own personal computer, create a key pair, a public key and a private key. This is a little computationally intensive. A bunch of prime numbers have to be multiplied together. Long numbers. So you create a key, which is actually a pair. You put the secret part on your secret key ring, you put the public part on your public key ring, and now you can share that public key with anybody in the world. And they could communicate with you securely. But, as you rightly ask, how will they know that this is not somebody spoofing? So what will happen to a key is that people who know for sure that it is yours will sign it. They will go through the same signing process of encrypting to their public key, and they will make a digital signature that says, I trust this key. So Tom makes one. In the example of our exercise, he makes a key, he puts it on the key servers. Now it's up there on the public servers, but who knows whether it's his or not. And he encrypts a message to me using my public key. And I receive the message, and I say, I can't read this because I don't have the public key of the author. So I go to the server, and I take down the key. And I read the message, which successfully decrypts, and now I know it was Jean who sent it, and this is the key he made. In the real world, if we were being secure about this, we might even do a little more testing, like I want to might meet him face to face, or have him read to me in a voice I recognize the summary of his key called fingerprint over the phone. But in this context of Technical Exercise 1, if you send me a message on a newly generated key, if I can get the key from the key servers, I can read the message, I know it's you, then I sign that key and I put the key back on the key servers with my signature on it. Now, if somebody wants to know whether it's Jean's key or not, he can look at it. If he knows my signature, if he trusts me, then he says, well, Evan wouldn't have signed this key if he didn't know it was Jean's key. But I'm really not a trusting person, so Evan might have made a mistake. Maybe somebody else also signed the key who trusts Jean and whom I trust. Inside a family, of course, family signatures would be really good. Inside a company, company signatures would be really good. In civil society, there are all some people that we think know how to do this correctly. They wouldn't have signed the key if they weren't absolutely certain whose key it was. This is why out there in the world, when hackers meet, they have a little piece slip of paper with a key fingerprint on it. They hold it up. They show up their identity card just in case you didn't know that they really had the identity they're claiming to have. And then the key exchange can proceed smoothly because everybody knows the key's out there on the public server. They don't need to exchange the key. They're exchanging information that makes trust. Zimmerman's greatest invention here, he put a lot of other good technology together, but his greatest innovation was the web of trust idea. That keys can be understood not in terms of somebody who authenticates to somebody in a hierarchy, but instead in a web in which our relations with human beings cause us to trust the keys that are presented to us because we trust the people who have trusted that key. And inside the PGP or GNU-PG, the free software equivalent, inside those programs is a whole trust management system in which you can say, listen, I don't trust the key unless three people I trust have signed it. Or I don't trust the key unless two people I trust have signed it and somebody else whose trust I really don't trust completely has signed it. Or whatever the rules are that you personally want to use. And in that process, by exchanging material, we create trust. Now, what can you do with that GPG or PGP program once you have it? Well, first of all, you can sew it into your email tool so that you can now send and receive encrypted email easily. That's the exercise you're going to perform with me. Make a key, put it on the servers, encrypt a message to me, and send it off. Now I receive it. I have now a message I can't read until I acquire the public key. I acquire the public key from the servers because you put it there, or I send you some email saying that didn't work, could you send it to me directly, please? Which is mostly because Apple is screwing with key management in its usual way. And then I say, good. So now I have sent you back an email message encrypted to your public key, which only your private key will read. I have put your key back on the servers with some trust in it. Just acknowledge that you could read the message I sent back. Now we've tested your full kit. You've encrypted a message to my key. You've made a key and put it on the servers. I verified that your key is there. I have signed it to put some trust on it. And I have sent you back an encrypted reply that you can read. Now you have all the kit. We've tested it all. We also are sure that you know how to teach somebody else how to do it because you learned it from scratch all by yourself. And once you know how to do it, you therefore know how to teach it. Now we can spread the web of trust. There's more that you can do with that GNU-PG form of public key encryption than to encrypt email only. You can also use it for encrypting files. And then you can drop them in Dropbox and other such places and feel some security that you're not going to be compromised because only the person who has the public key to whom you encrypted it can read it. That will immediately make possible an actually secure web for you. I'm not going to say I like Dropbox. There's lots of other ways that it could be done. But remember that at that point, whatever it is, if you have zipped up a little collection of files and you have encrypted it to somebody's public key, then you have effectively created a package that only they can open. And once you've created a package that only they can open, you can leave it lying around somewhere and be safe in that. Lawyers do incredibly dumb things with Dropbox all the time. I have never imagined a device for compromising attorney-client privilege as bad as Dropbox. But if every lawyer actually used GPG correctly, if every lawyer said, yeah, I can leave it on Dropbox because it's encrypted to the only person in the world I want to have read it, so good luck to you, it wouldn't be so bad. In general, indeed, what I'm saying is once you have mastered this particular exercise, you can teach anybody in the world how to communicate securely with you without first sharing any secret that anybody could steal. And you will have created a pathway in which messages, that is email, and files of any kind can be securely exchanged with people without ever having had to meet them first or know who they are or anything else beyond your ability in the web of trust to trust the key they gave you. If at that point you want to run a small journalism operation and you want to be able to securely get drops from people, good, fine. Publish the key, publish the instructions for having PGP for those who don't have those instructions yet, and you're finished. Quality? Excellent. All the way along. I can't prove that the NSA or the Chinese team never compromised PGP. I can't prove it. Because, of course, that's what the cyanide is in their teeth for. The single greatest secret of the listeners is always what can they read and what can they not. But I gained a little bit of unpleasant experience in the 90s in working for lawyers who did espionage defenses in cases in which PGP was involved. A drunkard and a corrupt man and a second-generation CIA officer, which is often a sign of problems, named Aldrich Ames, worked for the Russians for money for the better part of a decade and cost the Americans a bunch of lives. When Aldrich Ames was arrested and prosecuted, he had a home computer full of PGP encrypted documents, which were the documentation of a large part of his espionage, and having worked on that defense, I know at least that if the government had indeed the ability to read those documents, it was way too secret to be admitted in evidence in Ames's trial, which didn't occur because he pled guilty, as espionage defendants tend to do. But of course, I learned a bunch about gray mailing in those years, including doing a little of it myself in order to keep Zimmerman out of jail. So we never exactly know. If your threat model is that your email is going to be read by one of the two or three best teams in the world, PGP might not be enough, but there's nothing better you could have used. If your threat model is anything less than active listening by national means of intelligence, that is, the good teams in the world breaking in and stealing your communications, if your threat model is anything less than that, open PGP encryption is close to ideal. So the tool you are learning about will do those jobs. It will offer you an opportunity to understand how all this stuff works at the nuts and bolts level, or almost the nuts and bolts level. Think of it as nuts and bolts with a little fancy paint on them. It will offer you the opportunity to teach anybody else in the world you want to how to communicate securely with you and with anybody else they in turn want to communicate securely with. It's a pretty good deal. You should finish this one quickly. This is the one in which, because you need me to be the guy holding the other end of the rope, the sooner we do it, the sooner I can tell you, yeah, your kid is up and working and you're fine. Go teach some other people. Questions? Okay. So let us then, yeah.
So how should we find your public key?
Well, I suppose that you'll figure it out. I will say that on the public key servers, which every GPG client can read, my key is there. If you were to look on the homepage at moglin.law.columbia.edu, the key would be there. If you were to look at the website of the Software Freedom Law Center, you would see that we publish a fingerprint of each lawyer's key in order to make it possible for everybody who is a client to communicate with us securely, because they can get the key from the key servers and then they can check the published fingerprint at softwarefreedom.org. In general, the reason I'm telling you you should do it yourself is once you know how to do it yourself, you'll be able to do it for everybody else. But I've given you enough clues that it won't take you more than a couple of seconds. Other questions? Okay, so when we have completed exercise number one, what we have is the infrastructure of secret keeping, both industrially capable and well enough documented that you can learn about any piece of it any way you want. The manual is good, the documentation in the world, in the web is excellent. You can find out anything you want, and of course, we share this, so you can ask me. Exercise two should be to learn how to do proxy browsing, which you call having a VPN service, but Columbia having shut down its facilities and I not having created adequately secure alternate facilities, that's a gap. I'll fix this sooner or later, and you will still have a QNX login through at least next year. But okay, so one other piece of infrastructure, how to use insecure things like that mobile phone to browse more securely, I'm not doing right now. I'm skipping. If we try and ask what would happen if your personal technology were designed to support your privacy rights, we will, of course, be talking about an alternative to the phone. The phone is bad for two reasons, right? One, it's a spy satellite aimed at you, capable of being compromised remotely by people who own tools that are now way better than they should be. But the second reason is that it's really hard to modify the software on your phone, which is why nobody really does. iOS resists jailbreaking because the king of the undead, now dead, wants to enslave the human race to his software. Android devices are hard to break because, well, Huawei and Xiaomi stopped making modifiable devices and forced their software into jail because the party told them to. And other people's Android models are capable of running more or less stock Android, but they have their own little product differentiators in it, and everybody's eager for you to add other people's lousy application code. But people don't actually want you to experiment with multiple flavors of Android on the same device. They like you to stay within their own. So even though Android is in theory open source and very flexible and et cetera, for all practical purposes, aftermarket loading some other operating system on your phone is going to be a time-consuming and difficult, and may I say, of course, as everybody is afraid, largely irreversible activity. That doesn't mean it can't be done. If you wanted to de-Google an Android device, you could look at Lineage OS or slash e slash, one of the other forms of freer Android meant to be installed in aftermarket devices, but you probably don't want to do it. It's clumsy hacker work. We do it in the law firm because I have people who want to carry Android devices. iOS devices are, of course, excluded absolutely, totally, and forever. I did have one lawyer once who also carried an iPhone to work with a busted faceplate, so if anybody saw it, they would assume it was broken, and he kept it concealed on his person most of the time. Eventually, we did insist on its expulsion. But modifying that smart-ass phone so that it hurts you less, though possible, is fundamentally difficult. And as I say, the compromise behind all of this is I leave it in your pocket and hope that one day it gets lost and you never find it again. But we can imagine ways in which if we could change the software in devices, we could make devices that would do good things for us that we would accept as desirable even though they're not the convenience of the smartphone. And for this purpose, the laptop is the fulcrum. General purpose computing that you do own, that is powerful, that can do anything that you would want to have done, and which exists in a world in which free software largely conquered the technology pattern. That is to say, within some limits, set as usual by the overwhelming megalomania of the king of the undead, now dead, almost everybody's products are modifiable in ways which allow you to run other software operations and to gear yourself for systems that protect privacy. The difficulty, of course, is that you're terrified of changing the software on the laptop, too. The software in the laptop follows a technology pattern set by a company whose goal was upgrading compulsively in order to force old products off the market, as we were talking about last time. When a software monopolist wants to force old products off the market, it must break things. its upgrades have to be not just periodic, but destructive. If they interoperate with the old versions of the same software, the software will not achieve the goal of forcing old versions out of the market. So it is not merely an accident or bad technology, it's a function of the political economy of design that the laptop will break things as it upgrades. This is equally true of the properties of the King of the Undead, now dead, and the Orcs of Redmond, right? The mass market operating systems break things by design when you change them. And of course, they have no concept of endpoint software governance. That is to say, they treat the software running in the laptop, no matter who made the operating system, at least in the commercial world, they treat the software in the laptop as a thing that they want you to have trouble managing. Even the time machine and all the other bells and whistles doesn't actually make it easier for you to say, I want the Mac OS X I was running 5 years ago, I want it to be installed now, and I want it to work. So everybody's terrified of changing software in laptops. If they break the laptop, what are you going to do? This is why, of course, it is particularly, well, I don't even know which word to use, something that causes you to vomit anyway, that every semester the school forces people to change the software in their laptops to install actual malware, known to be malware, for the purpose of making it impossible for people to control their computers while they take exams. And every single semester, some people's systems are destroyed. And we have the usual absolute nervous breakdown. I was loading exam soft, and my Windows computer disappeared, and all my work, et cetera, et cetera. You're obviously right to be afraid. It's obvious that given the way the technology patterns work, anything that changes the software on the hard drive of your laptop risks horrendous outcomes, which is the result of capitalism producing inferior technology. Make no mistake about it. But maybe we shouldn't do it that way. Maybe what we should do is to recognize that the problem arises when we modify the software on the hard drive of the laptop. Let's just not do that. Let's just run the software that is running the laptop at the moment we're talking about off a removable device. Let's have the removable device, the USB key or something like it, contain the whole operating system of the computer and all of the data that the computer is going to touch or need. Let us assume that when that USB key boots up and starts running the laptop, it doesn't even try to talk to the hard drive. It treats that hard drive as hardware it knows nothing whatever about and will not change and cannot modify and won't hurt. We'll, of course, give you the opportunity to read and write on that hard drive if you want to, but we will assume that from the moment that you begin running the laptop in another flavor, all of that existing software and data that's contained on the hard drive of the laptop is as sealed as if it were in a different computer, which for all practical purposes it now is. Let's imagine, in other words, that we don't just jailbreak the laptop or make it possible to modify some software on the hard drive, like loading exam soft or getting rid of it. Let's imagine that we simply decide to repurpose the hardware of the laptop altogether and run different software on it. When you have learned to do that, you have learned to do more than one thing. Now we can begin to imagine the same computer which is being used in the ordinary way, doing the extremely convenient Windows or Mac OS X stuff that it does. Now we can imagine that laptop actually becoming a set of computers that do a set of different things. And you can swap them in and out in complete safety and without having to worry about what catastrophe am I going to do to myself that will make it impossible for me to resume normal work tomorrow morning? So now, exercise 2, is the beginning of that process. Once you have learned how to do one alternate operating system loaded on your laptop from a USB key, once you have learned to do that, there are many other things you can do. But we begin by freeing that endpoint. Our goal is to make it possible for you to use hardware you already possess to protect your rights in ways that the technology pattern embedded in that laptop doesn't currently do, because it is busy spying for Redmond, or because it is busy spying for Google, or because it is busy spying for Apple, or all three put together. Because there's malware that got there when you talked to a dodgy website, because there's cruft that built up in there over time, because if we were actually computer security consultants and we were presented with the laptop you currently run, we would be all upset immediately and take this away, but we don't have to worry about it, because when you're trying to do something secure, you're using that software. Oh, you do have to worry about it. I mean, one day you should stop running all that crap, but thing at a time. So technical exercise two says we're going to learn to load the first alternate operating system onto the laptop. And the alternate operating system we're going to load is called Tails. That stands for Amnesiac Incognito Live System, which is hacker jargon, but it means the following things. When you boot a Tails system, the moment you stop running it, the computer will forget everything that ever happened. Amnesia will set in. You put in the USB key, you press go, you get a system. The minute power is removed, everything is carefully arranged as the laptop goes down so that there is no trace left. Somebody actually good at forensics recovering the device will recover nothing. The incognito part is the central part. What happens when Tails boots is that all network interactions occur through Tor or not at all. In other words, everything you do without leaking any piece of information anywhere is being sent, bounced around through that whole anonymizing structure that we talked about earlier. All your network interventions are occurring through as much toroidal routing, as much sending around the donut again and again before they come out, as can be used to conceal who you are or where you are. Live system means, of course, that it boots off that USB stick. It doesn't need anything on the hard drive. It doesn't leave anything behind. If you want to read about all this, of course, it's in the instructions, but the place you want to look is tails.boom.org, which is the bunch of comrades in Switzerland who made Tails. Once you have learned to use a Tails USB key to boot your system from, you can, at any given moment, turn that laptop into the closest thing to an anonymous workstation on the net that present technology can achieve. If what you're trying to do is to make a computer that conceals your identity and your whereabouts as completely as possible, Tails is the choice. Of course, you don't bring up a Tails system in order to log in with your Google ID. You don't bring up a Tails system in order to use services for which you authenticate. You're not going to touch your Facebook page from it, unless for some particular reasons. And Facebook won't want you to show up anonymously through Tor. It hates that. But if what you're trying to do is to read in security, to stay off everybody's radar while reading the net, then exercise 2 by itself is sufficient. It has given you more because it has taught you how to modify the software on the laptop for other equally important reasons, but it has given you that. Exercise 2 concluded, you now have both ways of secret keeping and sharing with others, and you have a way to read anonymously on the net using hardware you already have. Exercise 3 says, good, now go make an email box. Because if you make an email box through Tor, you have invented an identity which is comparatively secure. I advise for a 30-day trial the German company, mailbox.org, which will let you open an email box through Tor for 30 days, and you don't want to use it for longer than 30 days because you don't want to pay mailbox.org in a traceable fashion, et cetera, et cetera. But disposable email accounts made through Tor using a tail system are as good as anonymous email gets, unless you're up against the best teams in the world. At the end of exercise 3, then, you possess a series of skills, of which actually the most important is the one that doesn't seem to have paid off yet, aside from being able to run tails, namely that you've turned your laptop into a multi-operating system object that you can use for other purposes and in other ways. Okay, I have now run as far over as I possibly can. There's office hours. There will be a queue for office hours, but please join me on the 6th floor if you want to, and we'll finish up next week. And you'll never have to think about any of this again, because who cares? See you later.